I'm in Harrogate at the UA Europe 2017 conference. It's the day of the general election, and I'm in the exhibition hall of the event, and I will be recording some sights and sounds from the conference and interviewing some of the speakers, and hopefully there won't be so many creaky floorboards.
Well, good morning, everyone. I'll introduce myself first, because sometimes I forget to do that. So my name's Matthew Ellison. I've got my name on the slide here. And I work for UA Europe, and I was responsible with Georgette for putting this event together and for choosing all the wonderful speakers that we have lined up for the event for you. So I'd like to welcome you all. Thank you for making it all the way to Harrogate. I know it was a long journey for some of you, and you're most welcome. So anyway, another year, 2017. We all come together because we all have in common a passion and interest in user assistance, whatever that may mean to you. Perhaps you write content, perhaps you design, you're an information architect, maybe you get involved in UI design, maybe you do user research. These are all skills and all activities that this community embraces and gets involved in, and what makes it so fun, I guess. Now, time to move on to the first presentation. I'm really, really pleased that Mark Baker accepted my invitation to be here. In fact, I tried to get him to the conference last year, but he was busy at that time, so I said, okay, keep putting in your diary for next year, and we managed to work it out. I've been a big fan of Mark's for many years. I'm one of the people who sort of stalks his blog. And I just sort of discovered him very gradually. I just kept reading. I was reading a lot of forums, and I would suddenly read this very eloquent prose, and I'd be reading it, and I'd think, hey, yeah, exactly. That's exactly what I think. Oh, that's so well put. And after a while, I began to realize it was always the same name cropping up each time that I read this kind of thing, and it was usually Mark Baker. Since then, of course, Mark has come up with this sort of very interesting philosophy of every page is page one, which I think expresses the philosophy of single source thing extremely well. And has written a book on the subject and is currently, I think, about to publish another book on the structured author.
Mark Baker, Analectic Communications.
And what you were the keynote speaker at the start of the conference, what was it you were talking about?
Well, I've been talking about the Every Page is Page One, which is, it's two things. It's an observation, principally, about how people use content today, that they dive in whenever they have a question, and wherever they land, that's their page one. And then secondarily, it's an information design approach that is a response to that behavior. Much of our information design has been based on theories about how people use content that we have known for a long time aren't true. They just don't do it that way. But they've been very long established, and so we've tended to follow the established ways of designing the content, even though we're very well aware that people aren't actually behaving that way. And so developing the principles of Every Page is Page One was simply an attempt to say, okay, let's deal with how people are actually using content and design for that.
And it's also a book. It's a book you wrote 3 years ago? Or?
Yes, it came out 3 years ago now. And it's done all right. Mm. It's done all right. The book really is... it's just the first half of it deals with how people use information today, why they do it that way, which is partly going back to some very basic things about the way that people are thinking as they're working and the kind of problems they face, and then looking also at how the web's changed that behavior. And in a sense, I think what the web has done is it hasn't taught people to want to access content in a different way. It simply made it so much easier for them to access it in that way that I think their patience with stuff that isn't designed to be accessed that way is very much less.
Yeah.
There's an expectation now that it should be much easier. And so that generates an additional need to design that way, because before it might not have been ideal, but it would be tolerated. Today it's less and less likely to be tolerated if it isn't designed to be read in the way people want to use it.
In that, if somebody comes to a page and they're told you've started in the wrong place, people are not willing to accept that. They expect, they land on a page, it gives them the information that they want.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people accept that search is an imperfect instrument. Mm-hmm. You know, I may end up in the wrong place, and this is well known. But your response to looking at a page and saying, nope, that's not what I wanted, is to go to the second search result and the third search result and the fourth search result. It isn't to say, I seem to have landed in the middle of something. I wonder if I poke about in it long enough, it will turn up the thing I was really looking for. Compared to going to the next search result, it's a really low chance. The one way you get people to do that is if you give them an immediate context. You're here. Ah, that sounds like close. It's what we call information sent. And it's been shown that people will click on multiple links if they perceive that the information sent is growing. As soon as they click on something and the information sent's no better than it was, I'm lost. I will go back to search again. So if you can establish information sent, and if you can have a linking strategy that will get people to where they really wanted to go, that they will do.
Yeah.
But if it's not that, then it's the next search result.
That's very much the philosophy of the gov.uk website and the GDS team that develops it, in that if somebody clicks a link from a page, that's seen as success. They're going to the right information. If they hit the internal search to put in a word to find something, that's judged a failure, that they couldn't find the information on the page, they couldn't find a link to it, and they've resorted to search, and that is the... So they look at the search results of the internal search to determine where they've gone wrong in their content, and it can be wrong type of terminology. They've used annual leave instead of holiday entitlement or something like that, where there's a mismatch. I wanted to ask you, so when the book was published, in many ways it was in some ways a manifesto of how content should change to meet what users want. I was interested whether since that book has been published, whether you've seen that wish for this to happen actually happen, and if there are any examples in the public domain that people might be able to look at to see examples of every page is page one applied in practice.
Yeah, I mean, the great example of every page is page one is Wikipedia.
Yeah.
You know, it is one of the points I always make about Wikipedia is it used to be an encyclopedia was in alphabetical order. Well, ask yourself what order Wikipedia is in. You just generally go Google search and there it is in your list of hits, and you go there and then you follow links. In terms of TechComp content that is every page is page one to that extent, it's still not a huge amount out there that I'd say that's exactly what you should do. Partly that's a lot of people who are doing this, and I've had a lot of people who've read the book and things like this, and have come up to me and said, well, we're trying to apply your principles, but a lot of that is still not on the public web.
Behind a firewall.
It's all behind a firewall, which is, I think, kind of tragic, because it seriously interferes with people actually finding the content they need, and it also deprives the companies of what is well established to be a great source of lead generation.
Yeah.
Christopher Ward particularly does some great presentations on the effect of public availability TechCom on the sales funnel. So there's a great loss there, but it's still difficult to point to it. The other thing that is a problem is that part of Every Page is Page One is building what I call a bottom-up information architecture. It's precisely that business of, if I'm close but I'm not there, I should be able to follow a link. Well, that requires creating an awful lot of links. And we really don't have tools still that are really efficient for doing that. We have tools that are great at finding broken links, but that's not really the issue. The issue is it costs a lot to find stuff to link to and to actually execute the link. We need to make that so much more straightforward and transparent because we don't have the legions of people going out and doing links the way we have in Wikipedia. And Wikipedia is richly linked because thousands of people add those links. It's still too hard. One of the messages I really want to get out is to the vendor community. We need to do something about linking. We're just not there on our linking tools. And so I've seen a lot of improvement in terms of content that works better when it's found. When the right piece of content is found, it establishes the context well, it is the right length, the right size. I've seen big improvements in that. But the linking still isn't there the way it should be. There's work to do here to get us to that point.
Did you see Caroline Loveridge's presentation on worked examples? I don't know if you saw that, but that reminded me very much of a sort of an Every Page is Page One philosophy.
Yeah, I did see it.
My name is Caroline Loveridge from Thermo Fisher Scientific, and the title of this talk is up on there, Teaching by Example, Worked Examples from Documentation of Complex Systems. So the purpose of this talk is to describe how we've used worked examples to give users a much deeper understanding of our system, and then to cover how we've developed our worked examples. So how we've chosen a scenario that is turned into a worked example, how we turn that scenario into an actually fully fleshed out piece of documentation. And then finally, the unexpected fringe benefits we had when we first started putting worked examples into our documentation. They turned out to be a great way to win friends and influence people with the documentation team, which we didn't anticipate at all. What do I mean by a worked example? In this case, what a worked example is a story. It tells people how they can use the software to solve a very, very, very specific problem that is based on a reasonably realistic, if simplified, real-world scenario.
One of the things that I think is really important in an Every Page is Page One environment is what I call the pathfinder. It's the way in.
The contextual setting of the scene, yeah.
The setting of the scene, because with the traditional approach, we've assumed that at the table of contents or the home page or chapter one of the book was the way in. Well, that doesn't work in an Every Page is Page One environment. We know that the home page, which used to be the big thing on the web, right? Everybody had to have their own home page. Well, nobody goes to home pages anymore. The home page is dead. People go directly to individual pages. And so there isn't that context setting, get me into it piece. And I think the worked examples she was talking about are a good way to do pathfinders because it gets you to somewhere where you say, now I recognize my problem. Yeah. And I recognize how this software works that problem. The one thing I'd say about that is, if that's your page one, but that's not executable in its own right, so there better be links that will take you, I recognize my problem, great, click on the link and I'm there, because otherwise they're back to search again. So that, again, comes down to the importance of linking.
So you're finalizing another book, which is due to be published shortly. Can you tell me what it's called, what it's about?
It's called Structured Writing. The subtitle keeps changing, but Currently, it is partitioning the complexity of content creation. And it is really trying to give a somewhat different vision of what structured writing is for. Structured writing has tended to be framed very much in terms of topic-based writing, single sourcing, content reuse, all of which are perfectly valid and useful applications of it. But it's actually a much broader concept than that, and there's far more we can do with it, including, of course, the linking, making the linking so much easier. But there's so much we can do in terms of content quality, in terms of, there was another presentation earlier today about the importance of templates in guiding your writing. And we can do all of that with structured writing.
My name is Kelly O'Brien. I am the self-service content manager for Kayako. I'm super excited to be here today to talk to all of you about two of my very favorite topics, information architecture and content templates. Give everybody a little bit of context for where I am coming from here. I am a docs team of one at a customer support software company. I work really closely with our support team and with our product team and with our marketing team to fill up our help center with useful information for our customers. Because I am the only person doing docs full-time, I've got a pretty full plate, and writing is only one part of that. I am also responsible for weighing in on UI decisions, for writing in product text, for updating the docs for our legacy product, for contributing to the company blog, and the list goes on. And I suspect that it's a list that sounds pretty familiar to a lot of people. So given all of that, if I am to have any hope of keeping my head above water, I found that I really, really need two things working for me at any given time. And one of those is a well-articulated information architecture that I can refer back to, and the other is a set of content templates that I trust to streamline my writing process and improve the quality of my content.
It's about trying to broaden that view of what we can do, and particularly what we can do in terms of content quality, not simply in terms of production, but the actual quality of the content itself.
So where does semantic markup and semantic information using things like task instead of heading one or definition instead of heading two, how does that fit into that structured writing objective?
Yeah, it's really interesting how the word semantic markup has kind of morphed multiple times. And one of the things I'm doing in the book is I'm trying to sort of give a new set of terminology, because I think everything has semantics. Everything means something. Semantic markup back in the day used to mean things that are specific to the subject matter, as opposed to the layout of the document, but we've got to the point where we're describing strong instead of bold in HTML as an example of semantic markup. Well, it's kind of really just a silly abstraction. It doesn't tell you anything more about what the piece of content is. For instance, if you replace italic with book title, because now you're saying why is this text italic? And then, because you've said it's a book title, you can do other useful things, like you can go through and you can find all the books that are mentioned in the text. So there's all kinds of stuff like that. The terminology I've adopted for that is to divide the structured writing world into four domains. So there's the media domain, which is essentially where HTML and CSS live. They're about what's it going to look like?
Yeah, the presentation layer.
Well, the formatting layer.
Okay.
Then there's the document domain, which is actually, I consider that to be a presentation. I'm going to use a table. I'm going to use a list. There's going to be chapters and sections. And technologies like DocBook and Markdown are squarely in the document domain. They're describing bits of documents. The base of Ditta, at least, is in the document domain. Then there is the management domain, things like conditional text, which are not about what is this content. They're about how am I managing it? What am I doing with
it? Personalizing it, contextualizing it.
And then finally, so there's the subject domain, what is the subject that I'm writing about here? And that has the sort of the micro thing where we're saying, oh, this is the title of a book, not simply something that should be italic. But there's also the macro level where you say, this is a recipe, or this is an API reference entry. The markup is actually telling you what kind of content it is at each level, and that's the level at which you start to control the rhetoric. You start to say, we are going to discuss this in this way, and we're going to make sure this information is included, and we're going to make sure that this other information that shouldn't be here isn't included, and it's all going to be very, very specific to the subject matter.
This is back to the information maps that you got with information mapping, back from sort of the early 60s and onwards in some ways.
In some ways, yes. I mean, this does come from, we've sort of been here a few times in the evolution of structured writing, where it's kind of gone more to the subject domain, and then it's kind of gone more to the document domain. And the attraction of the document domain is the document domain is essentially generic. You don't have to build anything yourself. Whereas if you're working in the subject domain, you've got to sit down and think about your subject matter and make up some markup to do this. And people tend to look at that and go, oh, that sounds hard, I won't do that. But there are such huge benefits that are associated with it that for many applications, your total development, your total amount of engineering you're going to have to do will actually go way down, and we can make it very much simpler for authors. We can get much higher quality content out of a wider range of people, because in the end, we have examples of subject domain structured writing all around us. Every time you fill out a form, you're doing subject domain structured writing, because it is this vehicle that is designed to pull out specifics of the subject matter. And so we know that this works really, really well. If you think about how you would write to a company to request something in the 19th century, you'd have written them a letter, and chances are you'd have missed something out, and they'd have written back to you. You'd have this whole correspondence. And today, you fill out a form, because they understand every kind of correspondence they're going to need to have, and they have a form for it. It guides the whole rhetoric of that conversation.
Now, if you take the form metaphor, a form for filling in a passport is different from a form for filling in, let's say, for an identity card or something like that, for another form. There's no universal standard of what a form looks like. There's commonalities to it, but then the software solves the problem of taking that data and doing something with it. Do you envisage that getting the benefits from doing it in that way would be derived from software, or whether this would be driven by standards and the intelligence, as it were, is built into the document itself, and everyone's writing, structured writing in essentially the same way, using the same tags, using the same format?
I think that all of the effort for having universal taxonomies, it's very useful stuff in the sense that at the universal level, if we have that, we can do all kinds of arbitration. The problem is that people in their local communities don't actually think in those terms, and it gets very difficult if you ask them to. What the machine can do that the human has a hard time doing is take a very local taxonomy, a very local way of describing things, and map it to the global. If we ask people to do that in their heads while they're writing, we know the performance on that is very poor. We know that if we have some huge content management system taxonomy that every author is asked, classify your content in these terms, for most of the time they will simply put in any term that will satisfy the thing, give them a green light so they can go on about their day. People are not good at classifying things on a global scale. They're very good at classifying things in their own local language. And so if you can localize this as the data collection point, you can globalize that in the background.
Hello, and thank you for coming. I'm Helena Pichler. I thought I'd share this one because I got very excited when I discovered it. Apparently. So if you use Spring REST API, you can automate your API documentation, or you can generate code snippets or code samples, as Alice said, for automatically. So what you need to do for that, you need to write unit tests. First you need the Spring REST docs project, and then if you use any Spring test frameworks, like Spring MVC test or REST Assured, you can write unit tests in those frameworks, and that those unit tests will generate your snippets. Those snippets you can then include, you can put references in your API guide to those snippets that will be generated automatically at build time, and then the ASCII doc document will pick them up, so your PDF can be generated automatically, your API guide, at build time, or HTML API guide, whichever your build is. So yeah, you just have to have this pre-configured document somewhere in your source control system that will be picking up and inserting these code samples. This is and there is a sample project on GitHub.
One issue, of course, is validation. With something like DITA or XML, there's a strict validation. You have rules for how things are entered if they're a certain type of information, and there's it's valid or it's not valid. If you move to the more looser way of giving people the freedom to express it in the way that's right for them at that local level, is a consequence of that it makes it a little bit trickier to have everything consistent in the same way. Is that, and if so, is that a problem?
Well, I think it's easier to validate something very specific to a particular point because then the rules are clearer. There are fewer exceptions, there are fewer ors. You know, the more things you try to do with one form, the more instructions you end up having written in there. Say, only fill out this section if it's a Thursday and you were born in May and all of these kinds of things. If you can give a separate form for each person for their particular circumstance, then there are very, you know, the rules are much simpler and much stricter, and that's easier to validate. So it's always easier to validate something simple and local. Now, the problem, of course, is you have many simple localities, so a system like that has lots of different touch points, but each one of them individually is simpler and can be validated more effectively. It comes down to a quality of data problem.
What other benefits are likely to come by having your content structured and structured consistently?
One of the big things I've always found when I ever go through an exercise with writers where we are doing a pretty strict subject domain analysis of their content is that we can take material that they say, look, this has been worked on by some really great tech writers for the last 10 years, it's been reviewed, we know it's complete, we know it's correct, we know it's consistent. And after a couple of hours going through this stuff, applying these things, why didn't we say that here? We said it on this example, gaps. On this example, but there's huge gaps.
Yeah.
When you do the semantics, there was a great example we had where we did this. What we were trying to do was connect the programmer's guide to the API reference. What we wanted was to be able to actually have live links from every time an API function was mentioned in the programmer's guide. So we marked it up, simply saying that's an API call. That's an API call. That was all we did. Well, we found that there were API calls that were mentioned in the programmer's guide weren't in the API reference. Turned out that for several releases of the software, part of the API had been marked up incorrectly, so a big chunk of the API wasn't being published. We found that there was one example which was written up using a private piece of API that had been written for one customer, was never supposed to have seen the light of day. We had a couple of examples that were written up using an obsolete API that had been deprecated three versions back. There was nothing for the new one. We found goodness knows how many misspelled, because you know what API, you often have these quite complicated camel case kind of things. It's very easy. And if you're just reading paper, you read right past them. We just actually had a presentation that one of the slides showed that if the words, if the first letter and the last letter is in the right, yeah. You read it, you don't notice that they've been reversed. Yeah. So we find lots of those. And this is just what's coming up mechanically is being exposed through having that specific semantics available. So it makes a huge difference. It catches all kinds of stuff that the best people, the best reviewers, the best tech writers, they just, you can't see it. Mm. So it makes a big difference.
I mean, in some ways, what's being described is documentation as an API, that you end up with with content that is shareable, that is that isn't necessarily fixed in its layout, but is has a description of it that means that it can be interchanged with other systems or other environments in that way.
Oh, exactly, and you know. It is very much documentation as API, and this is what APIs are designed to do, is they're designed to give you a clear local semantics for accessing functionality. Mm. And in a sense, we're giving clear local semantics for accessing meaning and content. So it's a really good parallel, in fact.
Mm. So the book is called...
Structured Writing.
It's XML Press, isn't
XML
it?
XML Press. Should be out sometime in the fall. You never
2017,
know. 2017, that's the plan. That's what I'm hoping. Hope my publisher isn't having a fit and hears this and going, no, it'll be later than that. But that's what it looks like.
Lovely. Brilliant. Thank you.
You're most welcome.